Okay, thank you very much. We'll come back to those predictions. And I've stolen, in the name of free speech, 5 minutes from our illustrious panel. We have probably the best panel I could imagine to discuss regulating the press this morning. I'm going to take them in the order on the programme. Tom Gibbons, Professor of Law at Manchester University, also was the advisor to the 2003 Putnam Committee on the 2003 Communications Bill, so he has a lot to answer for there. And Lara Fielden has contributed in the medicine process numerous excellent comparative research papers under the auspices of the Reuters Institute here in Oxford. And Eric Barent is the author, as you will know, of the classic foundational works on freedom of speech going back several decades in the UK, and he is Emeritus Professor of Law at UCL. So, Tom, we have a maximum of 15 minutes per speaker.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. After Hugh's comments, I wonder if what I'm going to be saying is going to be wildly aspirational and wholly unrealistic. I floated some of these ideas actually at a seminar that Rachel organised in Edinburgh some years ago, and I thought that Leveson might take up the theme of trust much more fully, and he didn't do that. And so I think it's appropriate to maybe discuss this matter again now. I think that the idea of trust is something that's bandied about and it's used as if it's an important consideration, but it doesn't actually seem to have much leverage in the Leveson recommendations, and I think that that's unfortunate. Whether anything can be done about that now is an interesting question, because as we're seeing, the discussion has moved on to practicalities and details and working out whether a particular scheme can be taken forward, and this is probably not the time in a way to suggest yet another pet scheme, and there are loads and loads of them around. But I think that actually in the battle, as Hugh puts it, for implementing something that's workable, the idea of trust and the idea of trusted journalism is something that could be played much more strongly, and I'm surprised that it's not being actually. Now, I should say that I'm not going to work through the paper, I'm going to talk to themes around the paper, but one of my starting points and basic assumptions, which you may shoot down, of course, immediately, is I have this idea that a distinction can be drawn between the media industry and journalism. And when I put this to journalists, they don't disagree with that. I mean, we know the realities of the media, the press industry in particular, and the fact that journalists may not be able to follow their sort of pure journalistic aspirations in an environment where commercial realities are that you've got to make the paper sell and you've got to get the stories out, and maybe corners have to be cut in doing that. But I do think that one of the problems with the discussion is that the distinction has not been as carefully drawn as it could be. And I think that if journalism, presumably as it's taught in journalism schools and so on, were given some space in the industry, some sort of regulatory protected space, then there would be much more scope for implementing the kinds of standards in the public interest that we all seem to think, I guess we all seem to think, as desirable. So that is a basic assumption there, and obviously if you think that that's unrealistic, then probably what I'm going to say next is not going to carry too much weight. But assuming that it makes some sense, I have to think about the idea of trust. And the thing about trust is that it's directed at creating a kind of independence of action on the part of the person who is trusted. Person doesn't have to be constantly watched over. One makes assumptions that behaviour will be appropriate because there's a pattern of behaviour that's gone before. That's what building a trusted relationship involves. And I think that on a personal level, there are all sorts of advantages to having a trusting relationship. It suggests a sharing of values. From a practical point of view, one isn't having to constantly triangulate, trying to work out whether or not somebody is, one doesn't have to be constantly checking that somebody's doing something that one expects them to be doing, and the trusting relationship, as it were, takes care of that. Now, whether that can be translated into an institutional set of arrangements is not so clear, and people do talk about the idea of having confidence rather than trust, perhaps, in an institution. The thing about confidence and moving into the institutional domain is that one starts to move away from the idea of personal trust that one doesn't ask questions. And one starts to move into a more externally orientated kind of relationship, which might also be thought of in terms of accountability. So you have to put structures in place that are there to check. The discussion about transparency, and you talked about transparency a lot, so did Leveson. Transparency is a manifestation of this concern with accountability. And the thing is that it's always about an external constraint being imposed on the behaviour, it seems to me. Now, it could be that is all that's necessary in constructing a regulatory scheme for the press. But I think that one might go further, and one might try to encourage the development of a trusting relationship, in this case between journalists and the public that they're writing for. A relationship where the public are not constantly having to, as it were, cross-check and triangulate news-gathering activities, the expression of statements as being truthful or not. I think that in terms of, I suppose, there's a kind of moral side to this. You know, it's a good thing for journalists to be trusted. I think also there's a constitutional dimension. I think the thing about journalism is that it does make a claim to be acting on behalf of the public. And we might be cynical about that, and given the state of the industry, we might be justified to a large extent. But journalism is taught, and it makes its claim, its special claims in relation to freedom of speech, on the basis that it is doing something special. And that special thing, I think, is related to this idea that journalists can be trusted to do things the appropriate way. And they themselves have a sense of what is the appropriate way to do things, and that is how they go about discussing their own ethics, and that's how their ethics is discussed in journalism schools, in university departments, and so on. I think actually also there's an interesting issue. We're concerned about the move from the press into the sort of digital world, and in both cases the movement to 24-hour news cycle. I think these days actually trust is even more important because of the vast amount of information that's out there. We need to set up a system where we can almost instantly be able to judge whether or not a story has some kind of credibility. We shouldn't be relying upon the possibility that some external scrutiny will have to cross-check that for us and give us that assurance. So I think there's a lot to be said for trying to promote some dimension of trust within a regulatory scheme. And the thing about Leveson's approach, it seems to me, is that he became very much concerned with looking at particular schemes. And most of these schemes are really externally orientated. They are essentially coercive in some way. There's either a combination of incentives of some sort, or there's a combination of sanctions. But either way, the idea is to try to force the press into doing something. Now, if you take the idea that there's a difference between journalists and the media industry, it seems to me that one could exert some leverage there by trying to set up a scheme where the incentives for the industry were tied to building trust in journalism. And that would also, I think, deal with, and this is partly reflected in Leveson's own scheme, deal with the problem of not trying to impose journalistic standards, trying to interfere with freedom of speech as it is spoken or written by journalists, by the state or by some regulatory body. The idea would be to encourage journalists to develop their own standards, to articulate them, to be as well proud of them, to take them forward, and to give them space to do that within the regulatory system. So in a way, regulation needs to protect journalists against the very industry that they are working in. I'm sure some journalists here might think that this is really getting aspirational. Get real. I don't think that we have to see all journalists all the time doing the sort of traditional investigative journalism that we sort of romantically perhaps remember. But I think that we have to create a way of protecting them against the clear pressures that have been well documented, where there isn't enough money, the news cycle requires the recycling of information, so-called journalism. So what I've done is I've thought about various mechanisms that might be more trust orientated or less, and that's what I've set out in the paper. And I don't propose to work through those in great detail, but the idea is to try to here at least the idea is to try to work out what might be conducive to trust building capacity within a scheme and what might be less so. And so that's where you see that the starting points, the dimension of a scheme that would be most conducive to trust would be some kind of institutional encouragement of the development of journalistic standards. So the College of Journalism idea is a way of describing that, and there are already institutions that describe themselves as the College of Journalism, for example, the BBC, but I was thinking more of a sort of almost industry-wide idea of journalism being supported in this way. There have been various suggestions for having journalist societies and so on. You get an example of trust building in journalistic ethics through notions in some newspapers of readers' editors, where you get a kind of dialogue with the readership about the dilemmas of journalistic decisions. That kind of discussion is the one that one would want to see promulgated much more widely institutionally. And the outcome of this, I think, could be, if you just let your imaginations at least fly for a small moment, one can imagine a system where journalists and newspapers who report into this kind of approach would actually take the initiative in dealing with problems with the readership. So they wouldn't, as it were, almost wait for complaints to come running. They wouldn't wait for apologies to be given, for compensation to be offered. They would do this because they would see it was in their interest to do this. They would be trusted not only in the journalism, they'd be trusted in the response to complaints about journalism. And I think that one could envisage then in a regulatory scheme some kind of graduated, or as I've described it, sort of ratcheted approach to regulation. The thing about trust is that one can lose trust on a personal level, but one can also regain it. One can demonstrate that one has turned the corner and is doing well again. And there are all sorts of analogies, which I'm not sure are entirely appropriate to the press, but you can think of putting people on probation, on parole, giving them a second chance. You recall years ago, Calcutt suggested this. I don't think it would result in an iron cage. Monroe described it. If you had a system that allowed some movement backwards and forwards between a more trusted form of regulation and a less trusted, the idea would be to incentivize the media industry to do something that encouraged journalism. So I think something like Leveson's proposal needs to be implemented. I think we as a society have to bite the bullet and say, yes, you've got to impose some kind of scheme on the media, on the press rather, and I don't think it's a major problem for freedom of speech as such. But I would see this kind of this regulatory oversight body, or whatever you want to describe it as ideally having some function as well, or it could have some function in being the decision maker for a ratcheting decision. You know, if a newspaper was behaving in a journalistic, trustworthy way, then they could be self-regulating on a kind of soft scheme that the overseeing body would recognise. But if they were not responding to their readerships or to complaints in the appropriate way, then it would be possible to move them onto a more independent regulator scheme of the kind that Leveson's decision should be created in any event. So I think that there's a lot of scope for supplementing with Leveson's proposals with much more positive measures to encourage the development of good journalism. And I'm surprised that that does not feature as part of the debate. Well, I'm surprised, I'm not surprised, because as you pointed out, you know, the real politics is that you want to get what you can, and these are subtleties that probably don't play very well in real life of politics.
Thank you very much for those subtleties. Hold on to your questions. We're going to discuss the papers together at the end. Laura.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here today to reflect on media law after Leveson. I should say that as a non-lawyer, I'm actually going to talk to you about ethical regulation, but within the wider context of the law. I'm going to ask what the draft Royal Charter really means when it sets out the three core touchstones of press regulation recommended by Lord Justice Leveson, that it is voluntary, independent, and self-regulatory. And I'm going to ask how far these are qualities that are reflected in regulation of the press overseas. I'm also going to look briefly at three other aspects of the draft charter's framework that we've heard briefly about: complaints, sanctions, and arbitration. And I'll end with some words of caution based on the experience of international regulation of journalism, not just in print, but across media platforms. My conclusions draw on my Reuters Institute comparative study of international press councils. As Damien said, it was the basis of my oral and written evidence, the Leveson Inquiry. If you want to have a look at it, it's on the Leveson and Reuters Institute websites. It was written during my visiting fellowship at the Institute after a career as a BBC producer and latterly as an Ofcom broadcasting regulator. And my research was based on interviews with press council chairs and ombudsmen from a wide range of mature democracies, each with a free press and each with a press or media council. So my first question is, how voluntary is voluntary? All the countries I've considered, bar one, which is Denmark, operate a voluntary system. In Germany, membership is so voluntary that a major publisher, Bauer Media Group, has recently opted out of its regulatory obligations, refusing to publish press council reprimands following breaches of the German press code. In Sweden and Finland, membership is also voluntary, but pressure is exerted by the strength of trade associations and journalist unions. So individual media companies belong automatically because of their membership of these organisations. Now, nothing in the draft charter makes membership of any new regulatory body mandatory. It states simply that membership should be open to all publishers. It's the amendments to the related Crime and Courts Bill that penalise those who are not members, with the potential, as we've heard, for exemplary damages and awards of costs. No other press council I have looked at makes this direct link between financial sanctions in the courts and membership of a press council. Indeed, for some, the very thought raises concerns about a sort of get-out-of-jail-free card for press council members, whereby a tick-box membership could reduce financial penalties. They argue this runs counter to the active ethical behaviour that they seek to encourage. But that doesn't mean that they don't incentivise membership in other ways. The Irish Defamation Act, for example, does something rather more subtle and light touch, yet wholly effective in persuading all mainstream publications in Ireland, and that includes UK titles circulating there, to join its system. The Act recognises a number of public interest defences for publications seeking to argue in defamation cases that a statement was fair and reasonable publication. One of these defences is that a publication was a member of the Irish Press Council, adhered by its code and abided by its determinations, or adhered to equivalent standards, which is a useful caveat for overseas providers. Thus, actively compliant members of the Irish Press Council can use their membership as part of a public interest defence. And then there is Denmark, exceptional among the countries I've looked at in that regulation of print as well as broadcast journalism is mandatory under the Danish Media Liability Act, which establishes the Press Council and a right of reply. There's no link between the Press Council and awards of damages by the courts. There's no power for the Press Council itself to fine. The only sanction at its disposal is to order an adjudication or a correction to be published. But if a publisher should fail to do so, a fine or 4-month prison sentence could in principle be imposed by the courts. Secondly, independence. How is that secured? The draft Royal Charter sets out an independent process to recognise and periodically review an independent new self-regulatory body or bodies. The board of the recognition panel is not to include any politicians, publishers, nor anyone who is or ever has been an editor. The appointments committee appointing the recognition panel is to be chaired by a public appointments assessor and not to include serving editors, publishers, politicians. And of course, the new regulator itself must have an independent board with a chair appointed by an independent majority appointment panel. Any complaints committee must have an independent majority. Independence runs through the entire framework envisaged. Overseas, press councils illustrate a wide variety of approaches to this notion of independence. For some, it means independence of the press from politicians, and the board is composed of industry only or industry majority commissioners. That's the case in Germany and Finland, respectively. For Sweden and Denmark, it's safeguarded through judicial appointments, so the chair and the vice chairs of both those press councils are judges. In Ireland, the independence of the Press Council in a similar way to the draft Royal Charter is secured by the criteria set out in the Irish Defamation Act. And this statutory recognition has gained ground elsewhere. Recent New Zealand proposals for a similar model give the responsibility for recognition to their independent regulator, the Chief Ombudsman. And thirdly, what is self-regulation? With the emphasis on independence set out in such detail in the draft Royal Charter, the nature of what actually constitutes self-regulation is thrown into question. As I've mentioned, for a country like Germany, it's regulation of the industry by the industry, no independent members on its board. Self-regulation is a protection against external interference with the press. The draft Royal Charter sets out the criteria by which a new regulatory body will be recognised, but it's for industry, as we've heard, to set about meeting that criteria and applying for recognition. This appears to be where self-regulation kicks in, as well as in the funding of the new body, which in common with most overseas press councils is the responsibility of the industry. But an important area of self-regulation has been reduced. Hitherto, the editor's code of practice, as its name suggests, has been the responsibility of an industry-only panel. This changes significantly under the draft Royal Charter, which sets out that the code committee must be composed of equal proportions of independent members, journalists, and editors, and it must consult publicly. And now for three key functions of the ethical regulator. Complaint handling. The Danish, Swedish and Irish press councils only accept complaints from those personally affected by the content, most commonly issues of privacy and reputation. Meanwhile, the Australian, Finnish and German press councils invite any member of the public or organisation to hold the press accountable by bringing a complaint, for example, about misleading information. It's a core distinction. The position adopted by the draft Royal Charter is the latter one. Anyone can make a complaint. Secondly, it sets out that the board should have the authority to investigate and impose sanctions of up to £1 million in the case of serious or systemic breaches of the code or failures to comply with the directions of the board. Overseas, press councils' main activity is complaint handling, combined perhaps with issuing a statement at times of press excess, or when press freedom is under pressure. Own initiative investigations by press councils are very rare. None are able to fine their members in this way. A public adjudication or a correction is their chief sanction. All are clear that they provide alternative remedies to fines and damages. And the third function is the inexpensive arbitral process for civil legal claims. These claims are distinct from complaints under the Ethical Code, but the arbitral process would fall within the ambit of the new regulator. The Press Councils I've looked at all counselled against any such blurring between ethical and legal boundaries. But that's not to say that issues of access to justice are ignored. In New Zealand, this issue has recently been addressed within the legal system. So communications tribunals have recently been established, sort of small claims court heard by district judges, offering citizens who can prove they've suffered significant harm speedy and effective remedies, such as takedown orders. Finally, a quick look at membership. The draft Royal Charter takes an inclusive approach. It sets out that membership of regulatory body should be open to all publishers on fair, reasonable and non-discriminatory terms. So the voluntary framework is open to any provider, new or old media of any size, unless already subject to broadcasting regulation. Eligibility for membership of a press council is an increasingly challenging issue across the globe. All the press councils explored in my report have extended membership to purely online providers, but they're all grappling with definitions of journalism, of editorial control across electronic media. Some, for example, Norway, are regulating Twitter and Facebook accounts as well as blogs. A key problem is how to reshape their funding and governance frameworks to include new media. One answer has been proposed in New Zealand, and I would really commend to you, it's long, but I'd commend it to you. The Law Commission there has produced this report just a couple of weeks ago, looking at this very issue. Their starting point is not phone hacking victims, nor police corruption, nor even actually the press. Their starting point is the public and the public interest in journalism. They identify the many ways in which, for democratic ends, we the public give the press privileges in our society. Access to information in, for example, court proceedings, confidential briefings, exemptions such as from data protection requirements, rights, protection of sources, and access to public interest defences. They remind us that in return, we have the right to expect those who hold power to account to be accountable for their power. The voluntary ethical regulation proposed in this report is a club that you want to be a member of if you want a simple mechanism to demonstrate your credibility and accountability in return for privileged access to information, public interest defences, and the right to display a standards, or what they call in New Zealand a qual mark, differentiating your offering for the public and also for advertisers. The most significant punishment for breaching those standards is not a fine, but suspension of membership. Their system would be entirely platform neutral, open to press, to online providers, and to broadcasters. And providers choosing not to participate would lose the ethical, legal, and brand advantages that membership provides, and would, of course, be subject to the law. Most importantly, the public will know who's in, who's out, and make their choices accordingly. So to sum up, the consensus among all the press councils I've looked at is that press regulation is concerned with ethical standards, accuracy, approaches to bereavement, interviewing children, that go far beyond the law, and with a speedy and cheap complaints mechanism that avoids costly litigation. Meanwhile, the courts are there to impose financial punishments and damages when the civil or criminal law is breached. Going forward, we will need clarity over the distinction between standards upheld by a code and rights upheld by the law. A blurring of the boundaries between the two will be a significant departure from regulatory systems elsewhere. On the other hand, the voluntary and independent framework set out in the Charter is a huge step forward in placing the public interest at the heart of regulation and publicly recognising and promoting the ethical standards expected of any provider of content on any platform who chooses to join. Indeed, a recent House of Lords Committee report on media conversion, third and final publication I'll commend to you, has suggested that non-public service television providers of news and current affairs should fall under the regulator to emerge from the Leveson report. This is clearly a shot across the bows for the framing of the Next Communications Act, And whatever the regulatory framework, ethical and legal, to emerge from next month's Privy Council consideration of the draft charter, it must be flexible enough to accommodate this next stage of the debate. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric.
Thank you very much indeed, Damien. Before I begin my paper, can I just to say that as one of the three editors here of the Journal of Media Law, the journal in its second issue this year, published just before Christmas, we hope, 2013, will publish any paper presented at this workshop which the author wants to send us in a perhaps a revised form, and we will publish it, provided, of course, that it meets the high standards of intellectual clarity and literary elegance that we expect from all our contributors. But we will be sending out an email to all presenters of papers here today, giving details of submission date and so word length and so on. Well, now on to my paper, which seeks to examine the arguments made in the Leveson report for and against a statutory underpinning of the new system of voluntary regulation which the report recommended. Lord Justice Leveson himself recognised that statutory underpinning of the new regulatory system would be, quote, the most controversial part of my recommendations. And so it proved to be in the 2 or 3 months after the publication of the report at the end of November last year. For David Cameron, the recommendation, quote unquote, crossed the Rubicon, which normally I thought, if I go back to my knowledge of Roman history, was a rather positive step, but he seems to use this negatively, pejoratively. The press viscerally opposes any degree of statutory regulation or underpinning. Whether that's still the ground for its continued reservations about full implementation of Leveson is a matter of some doubt, and perhaps we might discuss this after my paper is over. As you know, and as Lara has explained, the proposals will be implemented largely through the scheme of a royal charter, which Leveson himself, a possibility that Leveson didn't envisage. One preliminary point is this. A distinction should be drawn, perhaps, between statutory underpinning, as Leveson recommended, and statutory regulation of the press, which he did not, and quite explicitly, did not recommend. Under statutory regulation, the law, a statute, drafts press standards, the ethical standards by which the press is to comply, and perhaps also sets out the composition of the regulatory body. Leveson does not, as we have seen, recommend that. He recommends a system of voluntary, or if you like, self-regulation, which would be underpinned by statute. Statute might, in his view, set up the recognition authority which would validate and inspect the system of voluntary regulation. For the opponents of any form of statutory interference, the distinction is illusory. For Lord Black, the leading opponent of any degree of statute, statutory underpinning, he said, was simply a term of art for a form of statutory control. I don't think that is the case, but indeed his argument is in a sense at opposition to any form of statutory intervention, and we'll have a look at the merits of that later. For Leveson, the distinction between underpinning and regulation was crucial. He thought that that was an important point that he was recommending underpinning of a voluntary scheme, not statutory regulation. And you can make a comparison, if you like, between the scheme he envisaged and the scheme we have had for years, and which works very well, of voluntary regulation of advertising on the non-broadcasting media, which is done by the Advertising Standards Authority and the Committee of Advertising Practice, but is underpinned by regulations which recognise the value of the voluntary system of regulation. But there's another or third type of statute which is relevant, and that is statute which provides incentives for the press to join the regulatory system by giving those who have joined the voluntary system immunity from exemplary damages or a more favourable costs regime. The press doesn't seem to dislike that so much because it gives them advantages. Their opposition is to any statutory regulation which might work to their disadvantage. Does any form of statutory underpinning or regulation inhibit freedom of the press? Well, Leveson discusses freedom of the press very briefly in an early part of his report. It's about page 62 to 65, 66. He makes a number of points about press freedom. Press freedom is best viewed as an instrumental good. It's not identical to freedom of expression. The press should be subject to the rule of law and is accountable. And a statutory framework for press standards is not, as such, he argues, repugnant to press standards. Well, press freedom, rather. I'll deal with that shortly. And in this section, early section, he anticipates some of the points which he develops in his conclusions. Let's have a look at the press arguments against any form of statutory intervention. I think there are really three arguments, though one of them isn't really an argument. It's just the point we just don't like it and we'll resist it. The two arguments are, first of all, a philosophical objection, to use Lord Black's phrase, that any form of statutory intervention is intrinsically wrong, it amounts to state control, and therefore we have a philosophical objection, the argument of principle. The second argument is the slippery slope argument. It's a sort of Pandora's box argument. Once we allow statute in, then statute may, at the time of its passage through the Houses of Parliament or subsequently, be amended in a way which will be seriously inimical to press freedom. And it's that sort of argument which was made by many conservative opponents of Leveson after the report was published. We'll take the first argument, the argument of principle. Leveson's very unimpressed by that, and I think he's right to be unimpressed by it. He says the argument conflates, or if you like, confuses state censorship with the ordinary democratic processes of making and applying statute law. We have many laws, statutes, which impinge on press freedom. We have defamation acts, we have the Contempt of Court Act, and there is other legislation on media reporting. Many of the principles, indeed, of defamation law are in continental legal systems to be found in legislation labelled law of the press. I'm thinking in particular of the French law of the press, 1881, which contains the fundamental principles of defamation law in France. And as the expert group in Scotland said, and I commend their reports, which I read a few weeks ago, Leveson is proposing a, quote, comparatively light addition to the legal regulation already applying to the press. The slippery slope argument is equally risible. Lord Leveson pointed out that there was no basis for really apprehending that the Parliament would intervene to quash or restrict press freedom. In the last few years, Parliament has refrained, in my opinion, quite embarrassingly feebly from introducing privacy legislation. It's given the press very generous exemption from the data protection principles in Section 32 of the 1998 Act. And there are other examples of how it's refused on the whole to countenance any restriction on press freedom. And there's an argument of principle here that if the press is worried about Parliament acting to limit press freedom, it should make those arguments in Parliament itself, not avoid the forum altogether. So I think Leveson's rejection of the press's argument against statute is overwhelmingly convincing. And on that part of his report, I'd say, well done. What is the positive argument for statute? And on this part, I find his report somewhat less convincing. He first of all says it's desirable to have some form of statutory recognition to reward membership of a voluntary system to meet the standards set out by the editors or the drafters of the code. And he cites as an example the Irish Press Council, which gives membership of the voluntary body eligibility for a defence to a libel action, as Laura Fielden mentioned. Secondly, he says, and this is an interesting point, that statute may be the only way in which you can achieve or deliver the goal of comprehensive participation in the voluntary system. And I think this is a stumbling block to saying, yes, Leveson will be implemented. It's already clear that Private Eye, The Spectator, and, rather more surprisingly, The New Statesman will not play. The other major groups, apart from The Guardian, The Independent, and the FT, have reserved their position. They may not join the scheme, although Hugh Tomlinson has said that they probably will. Well, if they don't, the only way to implement Leveson will, as he himself reluctantly suggests, be to introduce a statute. And indeed, in anticipation of this, the Scottish Experts Group has said that statute is necessary to make plain what the jurisdiction of a voluntary body will be, which news media, not just press, but magazines and the social media and bloggers, will be covered by the new system of voluntary regulation. Leveson's final point is this, that statutory underpinning is necessary to achieve a quote-unquote satisfactory independent regulatory body. Otherwise, the public won't have confidence in the scheme, and courts and bodies like the Information Commissioner, which will have to decide whether the publisher was a member of a genuinely independent and effective regulator, won't have the assurance they're entitled to give the publisher immunity from the generally applicable law, which they would get as a member of the voluntary body. Leveson didn't, however, consider, as I've said, the use of a royal charter as an alternative, nor did he consider whether the press itself could ask a retired Supreme Court judge or justice of the law of the Court of Appeal, there are many of them, as it were, with perhaps time on their hands to do this, to set up or chair the recognition authority. That could have been done, but somehow, for reasons which I don't think he quite satisfactorily explained, Leveson said statute was necessary. Although I think the arguments against statute are risible and silly, the arguments for statute being absolutely necessary are, in my view, not quite clear. If we look at comparative experience, as Lara has done, then I think law can work perfectly well. It works in Finland and in other Scandinavian countries. It works in France. It works in all the German Länder, where each state has a press law to which no constitutional objection has ever, as far as I know, been taken in principle, although particular provisions on rights of reply have occasionally been challenged before the Constitutional Court and, in fact, upheld. So we either have to conclude that there is no free press in France or Germany or in Scandinavia, or we have to conclude that the press's arguments is overblown and that their objections, and this is my concluding point, are not so much philosophical as, to put it kindly, neurotic. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to all our speakers.